This episode of React Podcast is brought to you by reacttraining.com. In-person, hands-on training for development teams from React community leaders and experts. Visit reacttraining.com to learn more.
This is React Podcast, and today I have an incredibly special guest, the prolific Kent C. Dodds. Kent is one of the most prolific JavaScript developers I know. He is all over the place. He is a software engineer at PayPal on TC39. He has courses on Egghead and Frontend Masters, always putting out awesome libraries and talking about his experience. So it's a real honor to have him. Kent, how are you doing today?
Oh, wow. I'm feeling like embarrassed or like bashful for that really nice intro. Thank you so much, Michael. Yeah, doing great. Really happy to be here at React Rally 2018. I've come every year. It's my favorite conference, so I'm happy to be here.
It's a fun vibe here, isn't it?
Totally, totally. They give you plenty of time to chat with people, which is the reason you go to a conference.
Yes.
You get the talks and stuff on YouTube, and so everybody appreciates that. But the reason we go to the conference is so we can be there and meet people. And React Rally gives you 2 hours for lunch and gives you money to just go out to a restaurant somewhere with people and big breaks. So yeah, I just love that about React Rally.
Yeah, all those things seem to culminate in a really awesome audience experience as well. So all the, at least as far as I've noticed, the speakers kind of get up and they're like a little bit nervous, you know, like every time you kind of get up and you're feeling a little bit exposed. But every time, every talk so far, everyone in the audience has just been so eager to meet those people and like laughing at the jokes, kind of high-fiving and hollering and applauding at all the right places. It's just such a great conference to be at.
Yeah, it totally is. And I just huge props to Jameson Dance and Matt Zabriskie for all the work they put into it. And I know they have a lot of help from Sunny and her team. They do just put out amazing conferences. So yeah, huge props to them. No pun intended.
So I wanted to ask you, before we talk about some of your work and your classes and what you're helping people understand in the JavaScript community, how did you get into programming?
Oh, that was an unexpected question, but I'm glad you asked. It's kind of a fun story. So I'll try to keep it brief. I can ramble, so feel free to interrupt me. So when I was a kid, I never really was like into the computers thing beyond video games. I think that's pretty common. but my friend was like way into programming and stuff, and he tried to teach me, and I just remember him trying to explain a number, and I was like, okay, I get a number. And then he was explaining a Boolean, and I was like, oh, if you say so. and then he tried to explain a string to me, and I was totally lost. I was like, yeah, this programming thing is your thing, and I can appreciate you for who you are, but that's not me. And then I eventually went to school, went into electrical engineering, thinking I wanted to do whatever I wanted. And my brother did that, and he gets to do what he wants. So I was like, okay, yeah, computers are cool. That didn't work out very well for me. And eventually, and to do that, I had to take 2 programming classes. Okay. And I did okay, but I hated it. I was like, this is the worst. Like, why would anybody want to sit in front of a computer? And I think part of the reason that I didn't enjoy it was the TAs, the teaching assistants, convinced everybody to try to use Vim as their editor.
Oh, and that's a terrible way to start.
Right? Yeah. Like, I'm writing Java and C in Vim. Like, yeah, that was not fun at all.
Oh,
so I'm like, I can't even quit this editor. Like, why would I want to?
It's like learning to ride a bike in clogs.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So it was, that's great. Thanks, Michael. So I didn't really enjoy it, but eventually found my way into information systems, took another programming class. And at the time I had an internship, where I was required to do some monkey work stuff that was really boring. And I was in that programming class and I was like, not excited about that. Cause I knew I was not a programmer.
Yeah.
But, I was doing this monkey work. I didn't like monkey work either. So I started automating some of my monkey work with programming.
Okay.
And that's when it all took off for me. I was like, wait, so practical application, I'm not just doing linked lists now. I'm actually like doing something useful.
Yeah.
Hop, skip, and a jump to discovering JavaScript. And then I really got excited about programming.
Yeah. So you were kind of hooked by the fact that you could optimize the repetitive tasks.
Yeah, yeah. Like solve problems I was having using programming. I could turn myself into a thousand Kents using code, and I thought that was pretty cool.
A little army of Kents.
Yeah, exactly. Little Kent interns doing all this stuff for me.
That's awesome. So what inspires you to share your work and do all of the training work that you're doing these days?
Oh, that's a great question, Michael. So I feel like it's really important for people to recognize where the blessings in your life come from, and the privilege that we all inherently have. Everybody is privileged at one level or another. And I grew up in a stable family. I didn't ever wonder where my next meal was coming from. Mm-hmm. And so I had a childhood where I could learn and grow in a really nice and healthy environment. Yeah. I went to a really nice school that was supported by my family as well. And so so many things I didn't have to worry about so that I could get to where I am now. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I have a moral imperative to help other people who are who didn't have it as easy.
Yeah.
And so that's the biggest motivation for me. And that's why so much of the stuff that I do, I try to make as accessible as possible. So all of my workshop materials open source. Often I'll record my workshops and make it available on YouTube for free. And it's just because the people who can pay and who can support me, I appreciate them, and they will. And so I'm not worried about sharing the stuff that I know for free, because I know it's helping the people who can't, who can't pay. And so I'm glad to do that. It's also just like a blast and a half. It's so fun to talk to people who say that what I've created has helped them in some way. There's probably a little bit of ego, and I'm trying to get a handle on my own ego a little bit, make sure that I put my value where it should be.
It's hard. You see that Twitter account go up, you see the email list go up, and it's kind of hard to not think that, I'm pretty awesome.
Yeah, it is. It is hard. And there's nothing wrong with getting a following. Like it's part of my career.
Yeah.
It's an important part of that. But yeah, I have been recently really focusing my mental brain power on how can I make sure that I'm putting my self-worth in things that I can control and things that actually are healthy for me to feel good about. Because if something wild happens, React goes out of favor, or something terrible happens, I don't want to feel like a failure of a human being.
Yeah.
When something that may have been out of my control happens. So yeah, I think a lot of people, I would encourage a lot of people to really get introspective about themselves and where they are feeling their worth, because you don't want somebody telling you that they don't like you to ruin your day. And for a long time, that's been me. So it's a constant effort, but I'm glad to help the people that I do. And it's a lot of fun.
We talked with Ken a few weeks back. And he was saying what a weird transition that is, especially in open source and programming right now, where you put something out in the wild and you don't really think much about it. Like when you're starting, you're just going to put it out there and then maybe it gets successful. And then people start following you on Twitter and all this stuff. And it feels really great until people start hating you on Twitter and filing these issues, telling you what an idiot you are for using this pattern or doing something in a non-performant way or whatever. And so I think that's really valuable, what you're saying, to be introspective about how you're feeling about things and accept those good parts of that and realize that there's going to be bad parts that come along with that. But realize that none of that is you as a person, right? And if someone doesn't like what you're putting out into the world, that's not a bad on you. You can still be whole and happy, even if there's people that aren't in the Kent C. Dodds camp.
yeah, totally. I've learned over the years of open source that I've been in things. I've been pretty fortunate to not get a lot of hate mail or anything, but I've definitely gotten a little bit. And earlier on, it was they're slighting my honor or something but it wasn't, I wouldn't get mad at them. I would feel bad about myself.
Sure, yeah.
And maybe I'm a little bit mad at them. But so it just really impacted, like, because I am my code, right? Like, that was the attitude that I had. And so getting yourself out of that is a really important part of your own mental health. And now, like, it used to be that somebody would file an issue and I'd respond, like, instantly and say, time me, I'll get this released in 5 minutes. this happened once, and then I released it, and it was 7 minutes. And I was like, oh, sorry, I didn't, like, fix that bug in 5 minutes. And I felt so cool about myself. I think it was a feature. It wasn't a bug. It was a feature that somebody else needed, I didn't need. And so I found that that's a really awesome path to burnout.
Yeah.
And so I've found a way around burnout, and that's basically, if I don't want to do it or I don't need to do it, then I won't do it. And so, like, I have open issues on my projects, like, all over the place that are just like, I just add a label help wanted, and sometimes I don't respond, and I feel bad about that, but I, like, people have to understand, I get dozens and like at least 50 questions or issues or, like, Twitter DMs a day.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of figure out how to optimize for your own happiness first, and then serving other people as well. So often, like, if it's a project I'm interested in, then I'll continue to do things I don't need because it's something I want to do. But if I start losing interest in the project, then, like, I'm definitely another aspect of this is making it really easy to contribute to, and then giving ownership as well. Because the people who are using the project should be the ones building it too. There's that side of it as well, of being, like, really free and open with the contributor rights. But yeah, that's been really helpful to me, is just, like, I only do the stuff I want to do or need to do for work or something, and I don't do anything else. And then that's kind of how I avoid burnout. It's worked out pretty well.
Good. You have to decide where your time is best spent too, because as someone who wants to make sure that people have the tools they need to progress in their careers, their understanding of things, maybe fixing that issue isn't your best time spent, and you can help a lot more people if you do something else.
That's very true. Yeah. Like, I'll get Twitter DMs on a regular basis. Like, here's a question, and I'll normally direct them to my AMA because that's a public forum where I can answer their question and help a lot more people. So that's worked out really well. Or sometimes I won't be able to respond because you do have to prioritize. Another thing with that is finding ways to increase the impact of solving their problem. So early on in open source, they'd say, I have this use case, and I'd add a part to the API for that use case. Had a lot of, like, single use case API features on a lot of things. And recently, and maybe this is a good segue into what we're going to talk about, but recently I've been taking a step back and thinking, what's the broader use case, or what's something that I could do to kind of invert control or just give more flexibility and power so that they can solve this use case, but also solve a whole myriad of others so that I don't get the issues. The problems are already solved.
Yeah.
And that's actually worked out really well for me recently.
So I saw a lot of your exploring these concepts. You kind of explored out in the open as you were creating Downshift, which is at a high level kind of a drop-down library, right, for React?
Like, autocomplete, like, I think I call them enhanced inputs.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So this is where a lot of your work had started, in this kind of idea of React component composition and how to, like you said, invert control, allow people to compose their own things together from these much smaller kind of single responsibility components. Can you talk about, you know, the experience that you had and, like, the things that you learned throughout that process?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Because this gives me a great opportunity to thank people who helped in the creation of Downshift. So I coded it myself mostly, and I live streamed coding it too. So people can watch in two parts. It was like 2 days worth of coding all day, pretty much, of me getting to what is the final version of Downshift. And since then, it's been subtle features and things to handle use cases. The process of creating it, or the motivation originally was, we had this we had three implementations of autocomplete or auto select, whatever, in our app.
Some type of form element.
Yeah. For enhanced input where you type and a drop down comes and it filters and you can click on one or select one. So we had a country selector, recipient selector, and then another recipient selector that was styled differently. So it had to be completely different implementation altogether.
And this is at PayPal.
At PayPal, yeah. In one repository.
Okay.
And I'm sure like there are dozens of other re-implementations of the same thing in other repos. And some of these were like open source projects that we forked, that somebody forked. Wasn't me, but like forked it internally and just committed it to the code base and made alterations. So I was tasked with taking our country selector and adding it to another page that was technically in a separate app, just in the same repo. And I found it to be really difficult because it was coded so specifically to where it was. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, this is the worst. We already have three implementations of autocomplete. I'm thinking about making another one. Just for this, I'm going to make the end all be all autocomplete that just works for everything. And before I built it, I looked around at other solutions and thought like maybe we could retrofit some of these, make our own that uses one of these under the hood. And none of them were flexible enough for my use cases, my varied use cases. So
because you probably find yourself like adding a ton of props to those interfaces, right?
Yes.
To make it. And then it's just kind of inside this big conditional mess of, yeah. Well, if it's not a country selector, it's a whatever
yeah,
else.
So
selector.
You may as well just make two separate components. Yeah, exactly. No, that's totally, totally it. And so around the same time, I watched a talk at the Phoenix.js meetup or Phoenix React meetup that Ryan Florence gave called Compound Components. And I was just like really inspired by that concept. It was the first time I'd heard of Compound Components. And so when I started building Downshift, I was like, okay, so we could have the Downshift and then we could have Downshift input, Downshift menu, Downshift item. Downshift label for accessibility, all these things. And so that's how I started. So if you watch the live stream, you'll see that's how I built it initially. And then I got to this point where I was like, I didn't understand this at the time, but compound components are really good at allowing you to use components that share implicit states. So they kind of hide the state behind the scenes. So like the is open state, the highlighted item state, all of that. And so that's nice because you don't have to worry yourself about that. You just use the components and they work together magically. You got to watch this because the things that I did to make this work with context, and I was like sharing the component instance across these different components. Yeah. It was just a nightmare, but it worked.
One of the kind of challenges with this idea of inversion of control is state and kind of state that comes from the developer who's developing it, or this, like you said, implicit internal state of the actual components. And I'm sure that it can feel at times like if you expose just a little bit too much of that, it feels like they're just re-implementing the whole thing from scratch anyway, and that maybe they're not gaining a lot of benefit from the components. Is that
about? Some people feel that way about Downshift as it currently is.
Okay.
And so I got to a point with these compound components that I was like, in Downshift, there are four items of state, and it's always just been four, which has always been surprising to me. But there's the selected item, the input value, highlighted item, and the is open state.
Okay.
And I found myself in building out this component and different ideas of how it could be used. I needed those items of state for one reason or another, whether it be styling the highlighted item differently or the selected item differently. That I think that was mostly the use case. I was like, well, how do you do that? In addition to that, I didn't like how, like, let's say you want to have a styled input, like styled components or emotion. And so now with my Downshift input, it's rendering an input component or element.
Sure.
And you want to have it render your input component that you have styled and stuff. So now each one of these compound components takes a component prop. And you pass your own component. I hate the idea of a component prop.
Really?
Yeah. To me, that communicates that we are not giving you enough flexibility and control.
Okay.
So I didn't like that very much, but I couldn't think of any other way to do it, but I did need to get these four items of state somehow so I could like interact with them in some way. And so I thought, well, I have this component, maybe I pass them as props, or like I couldn't quite get it. But then I don't remember where I saw, was reminded of the render props pattern. Mm-hmm. But like Ryan and Michael Jackson have been talking about it a lot. And I remember seeing it in React Spring. I think that's the first place it was really popular. Yeah. Or not React Spring,
React Motion.
Yeah. And
that was the first time I saw it at React Europe. And mm-hmm. I was like, what is this voodoo? Like, yeah. I don't even understand
this is magic.
What this code does.
Yeah, yeah. Most people had that reaction, I think. Yeah, and I remember Merrick Christensen also was pretty into this. He called it function as child components. Uh-huh. Has a blog post about that a couple of years ago. And yeah, so I thought that was interesting. So I was like, okay, so I'll have another compound component called a downshift controller. And that will use a render prop and I can get access. So anywhere I need it, I'll just get access. And as I was like working around with some of the examples, I slowly like... just in the JSX, I'd have a downshift controller here, one here. And I was like, why don't I just like do one bigger and it can encapsulate everything.
Yeah.
And I kept going bigger and bigger until it was like downshift and then downshift controller and the whole thing's a render problem. I was like, wait a second. Maybe I should just make downshift itself a render prop.
Yeah.
And when I made that switch, and I think I have that on the recording too, when I realized that and made that switch, then things started to really turn around. So at first there was like a performance issue that I thought I had, and I'm still not sure what that was because downshift's like crazy fast.
Yeah.
Thanks to React, of course. So I'm not sure what that was all about, but it's...
Was it about the certain, the builds you were using?
It could have been. Yeah.
I remember seeing tweets about that and it was kind of never quite made clear what exactly it was.
Yeah, what happened there, yeah. And like, even in development build still, like, I haven't been able to make it slow. Like, the other day, somebody said, hey, I've got 180,000 students I'm filtering on downshift. And when you get that much, like, you've got to use windowing. I don't care what library you're doing. So he had windowing, but he was also using another library I made called Match Sorter that'll have, like, a human, human reasonable filtering mm-hmm. capabilities. And that was the thing that was slow. And so when I took that out, downshift was like, yeah, having fun all day. Like, this is no problem. So yeah, downshift is like crazy fast. I still want to give credit to another person who really helped. And that is, I had a problem with, I've got a bunch of props I need to apply to the input. And so I'm still using the compound components, mm-hmm. just downshift is now also a render prop, and then I have these compound components. So I wanted to get rid of that component prop, but I still needed to somehow apply these props to the input, mm-hmm. Like ARIA attributes for accessibility and things like that.
Because when you control the component, you know which props to accept, mm-hmm. which ones you're going to get from your own render prop.
Exactly.
Right? But when you don't, if you want to invert that control and say, like, you can use this with any input, like basic input elements or your own styled input elements, then you have to get a little bit creative.
Exactly. Exactly. So I was like, well, shoot, I don't want to make it So the idea of inversion of control, which is what you're doing when you're implementing a render prop, is you give a lot more work to the end user, but mm-hmm. in exchange, they get a lot more flexibility. Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's in my mind, it's worth it. And especially with React's composability model, you can make your own implementation of a downshift, and then you just use it like you would a normal thing. But then you can dive deep if you need to get the flexibility. But the problem is that now they have to start applying all the props that they need to. And Jared Forsyth, I just randomly ran into in the San Jose airport around the same time. And he said, I showed it to, I was like, we were about to get on the plane and I wasn't sure I was going to sit next to him or anything. So I was like, hey, listen, could I show you something really quick? I want your opinion. And he said, well, what if you had like this collection of props, like this object that you spread, you tell people to spread this on the input, like mm-hmm. wherever they render it. And I was like, oh, sweet. Yeah, that's a great idea. And so that's where the props collection idea came out of. Was it's a, just I say here's the props you should apply to your input, and now all the you don't have to worry about it. So it's a little bit more work, but it's not so much that it's unreasonable.
Sure.
Like the alternative was you have to render this downshift input. Well, now you can render anything you want and just apply these props. So it's just as much work. It's just different work.
Now, are some of these props things like accessibility?
Yeah, lots related? Of accessibility and as well as interaction. So as you're typing, like an on change, on key up, and things like that. Yep, gotcha. Exactly. Also, I should mention Ryan Florence built a React autocomplete a long time ago. I think it was one of the first components he built. And I stole a lot of things from him. Like if you look at React autocomplete, and how it interacts with event handlers on the input, and then look at downshift, it's like copy paste in some areas there. So big thanks to Ryan again.
That guy always seems to be ahead of the curve somehow.
Oh, he is. Yeah, he's great. And now he's working on all this React suspense stuff.
Yeah.
He's got like workshop material almost ready for it. It's not released yet. He's he has all the problems that require these solutions.
Yes.
And so he, that's why he's ahead of the curve, is he recognizes, like lots of us, we just like, this is the world we live in.
Yeah.
For Ryan, he recognizes, no, this is a problem. It doesn't have to be this way.
Yes.
And so he finds the solutions, which is cool. And the React team's doing that as well, of course.
Yeah.
So anyway, one last thing on building downshift, or maybe a couple more things. So, the prop collections is great, but, so I'm applying an onChange, but what if you want to add your own onChange to the input? Mm. Now you're going to override mine. And so that's when I changed to prop getters, where it's a function that you call, and any props that you want to add to the input, you add those to the prop getter. So instead of input props and spread that across your input, it's get input props that'll return an object that you spread across. And so then you call that with any other props you want applied, and then we'll compose that for you. Okay. So call yours and mine together to make it work together. So that's where prop collections went to prop getters. Okay. Yeah. So that was cool.
So how has that project continued to go? It's been about a year?
Good question. I think not quite a year. No. Okay. I think I built it this year. No, I can't remember.
Okay. Maybe it was around like the winter. I feel like it was cold.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cold and dark.
Kinsey dads emerged from the snow.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure I built Downshift a few months after Glamorous, like maybe 6 months after Glamorous. And Glamorous was April of last year.
Okay.
So yeah, probably around November or something.
Gotcha. And it's still servicing the components at PayPal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, lots of components at PayPal are being used in there. Code Sandbox is using it. They were the first.
Oh,
actually,
awesome.
Evis was the first one to ship Downshift to production.
Wow.
Yeah, so he beat me.
another human that's in front of the curve.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah, that guy is just incredible. Proud supporter of Evis for sure. He's great.
Yeah, I was blown away at just the rapid trajectory of Code Sandbox in the React community.
Mm-hmm.
People just love it.
It's taken over. I'm featuring it in my talk, doing live coding in Code Sandbox because it's just so great. I built Downshift in Code Sandbox. So the live stream, I just couldn't beat the developer experience.
No.
My editor wasn't good enough. So yeah, it's great. And now I can use Sarah Drasner's Night Owl theme in Code Sandbox.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm all set. Like I'm pretty happy there.
I love Code Sandbox, especially, do you use it for your trainings?
So like my Advanced React Patterns course and my beginner or intro to React, you can do the whole thing, including run the tests in Code Sandbox.
That's awesome.
It's incredible.
Yeah. He really came across something awesome there. And I particularly for teaching, it is such an invaluable tool. And I had a friend who was just, who's learning coding for the very first time, like knew a little bit of HTML just because he had Squarespace site.
Squarespace. Uh-huh.
And so he had a couple things that he would like do in HTML or whatnot.
Like little widgets and things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he was starting for the first time. And so I was like, okay, use like there are no other editors on the planet except for Code Sandbox. This is the only editor, right? And so he worked on it, and you could tell, like, at some point he got a little bit like tired, just kind of like being in the sandbox. Hmm. And I was like, dude, I'm about to blow your mind. Like, you just push the, like, you got to create an account, but then just push this button, and now it's like on the internet.
Yes.
And I was like, that is the feeling that I remember having when I started, where I was like, I could put an HTML file up on the internet, and like, now anyone could see it.
Yeah. You call your friend across the street and like, dude, go to this URL. It's like 30 characters long and it's got like 3 dots in it. Yes. But yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I love about that project is that he's found a way to kind of bring that awesome experience of like, okay, I'm learning something, and like, now it's on the internet. Like, this is awesome. I am amazing.
Yeah. That's a wonderful feeling. And, I've built several applications that I'm using on a regular basis, 100% in Code Sandbox, and deployed them. I never downloaded the code.
Yeah.
It's, well, I mean, you download it in your browser, but
sure.
But yeah, never opened it in an IDE, locally. So it's amazing.
So what are some of the things that you find when you're teaching your classes on composition that people have the hardest time understanding? Even people who have been using React for a long time, like, what is the thing that kind of holds them back from these compositional patterns?
I think a lot of people assume that these patterns are reserved for highly reusable and flexible components.
Mm.
Where that is true, that it's not reserved, but they're very applicable to those kinds of components. These patterns are also really useful for separation of concerns. It's probably the biggest thing is, like with downshift, it's separation of concerns. We're separating the logic for an autocomplete or a dropdown with the way it looks.
Yeah.
It's almost like classic model view controller. The model and the controller live inside downshift, and the view is all yours.
Mm.
But it's implemented within React's composition model, and so it exposes a really nice and declarative and explicit API. It's perfectly fine to implement, and it's a great thing to implement these patterns for a one-time use component as a mechanism for separating concerns. I think another thing that really trips people up is understanding that JSX and React is just JavaScript.
Yeah.
And so, like, when you and I saw the render prompt pattern for the first time, we're like, what is this voodoo magic?
Yeah.
Like, what is happening? But if you, like, a really valuable skill that everybody should learn, and maybe you can even practice this, look at some JSX and transpile it, like, code it yourself, react.createElement. Until you can do that and then do that in your head, you will be a little bit stuck. But if you can, once you are at that level, and if we were at that level at the time, at least I don't know about you, but at that time I was not at that level. So that's why I thought it was voodoo magic. But if I knew, then I could have just seen, oh, that's just passing a function as the argument to a function call.
That was when it clicked for me, is when I wrote it out as react.createElement and provided all the arguments. I'm like, oh, I get it now. Instead of like doing a string or another element, I'm just giving it a function. That's when it all kind of clicked for me, is when you take the JSX out of it. Because one of the hardest things about React is that JSX is awesome, and I prefer it. I like writing in it. But there's a lot of baggage that I have from having written HTML for a long time.
Yeah.
And that kind of creeps up on me sometimes. I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot that this is just a function. And, you know, doesn't have all of these characteristics of actual HTML.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not only that, but it also, like, just because it appears in the children prop spot, or it's called render or something, like, just because that's where it is, doesn't mean that's how the component that you're passing it to is using it.
Yes.
And so, like, you look at any render prop component that's using children as the prop, then you're going to see it's calling children, invoke that function.
Yeah.
And so having a solid understanding of JSX is really just JavaScript, kind of hidden behind a very nice, clean, declarative abstraction. And then also JavaScript expressions really tie people up too. And so learning and understanding what you can put between those curly braces and what happens to the stuff in those curly braces in the transpilation process, that can really help too. Because once you have that fundamental understanding, then a whole new world of possibilities opens up to you, because you you know that, oh, I'm actually just calling a function.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
Yeah, it's it really is amazing how that kind of becomes your hammer pretty quickly.
Yeah, it does. It can be overused too. Everything's a nail.
So your talk tomorrow, what's the big theme?
So the big theme is your components don't have to be complicated. So it's simply React. So it also is kind of like, hey, let's take a step back. You don't have to have these big abstractions like state management libraries and things to accomplish great things in React. Yeah. And so like you simply need React. Like it's simply React. Anyway. so the theme of the talk is we have an accordion component. Most people can relate to an accordion or can catch up pretty quick on what it would be like to build one. And a lot of people can relate to this. So you build a component for a single use case, and then somebody sees that and says, that'd be great if I could use it over here. And you say, awesome. And then they add a like, oh, but I need it to behave differently, or I need it to look differently. And so you start adding props to this thing to support these use cases, which is fine. Yeah. The whole time you should be optimizing for deletability. And so like whether it's adding props or duplicating the code, it's probably fine. Like a single if statement isn't going to kill anybody.
Right.
The problem comes when more and more use cases keep coming. And now your 30 line component is like 300 lines of conditional if statements in your click handlers and in set states and all this stuff. And then somebody throws in Redux and now nobody knows what the code is.
Well, and you have like maybe 15, 20 lines of required props then too.
Exactly. In my research for this, I found a date picker component that had 125 props.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It's open source and quote, reusable. I'm sure it's reusable. You can use it for many use cases. But so there, I talk about that and most people can relate to that. Like you've had a component that you start piling use cases on and it gets complicated. So that I call that the life cycle of a component, not the component life cycle, the life cycle of a component. There are a couple problems with this. So your bundle size gets bigger for to support use cases that you don't really, for your app, it doesn't matter. Sure. You don't need them at all. As a user of this, the API is really complex. So every single prop for every use case, you have to read like, do I need this prop? No, no, no. And like 30 props and like, oh, maybe I do. I don't know if I need that prop. And then as a maintainer, you have to document all those and keep that documentation updated. And then implementing it is a pain in the rear. And like anytime somebody wants to contribute, they have to learn this really big code base. And so you're always thinking about, am I breaking these use cases and things? So,
Well, and there's an additional cost of every time you use it, you kind of define that, those props that are required for that, that space, but then it becomes really difficult as maintaining the project to change those.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Because now someone's going to have, if they use your component in 50 places, they have, they, if they want to update, they have to change it in all of those 50 places.
Yeah, exactly. That's where composition comes in. They should wrap it in their own implementation or something. Then they only have to change it in the one, but still like it is a maintenance and a user burden as a single component gets more and more flexible. But it doesn't have to be this way. And I have this big reveal, in my talk, where you could implement a component that's that flexible, just using a couple patterns that, invert control. That's the biggest thing that I've discovered recently or learned recently is, the power of inversion of control.
Yeah.
And so when people keep asking you to add use cases, what they're really asking is, I need more control.
Yes.
What they're saying is, I need more control. And so by implementing certain patterns, you can give them that control and reduce the maintenance burden on yourself and increase the flexibility and simplicity for the consumers. And so the talk is mostly like, let's get on the same level here. We all know that this is awful. There's a better way to do this. And then I don't really explain how. I don't have time to get into the how you implement these patterns. But I do demo, like, now that we have these things, when that person comes to you and says, I need it to look different, you literally just change this. And I have a little bit of live coding to show, like, so you just tell your coworker, copy these 25 lines, paste them, and move this. And that's all. And it's very straightforward. There's less of an API surface area. Yeah. One of my favorite types of props is like render expand all button. Mm-hmm. And you don't need something like that when you give people a render prop, because they literally, if I don't want to render the expand all button, I remove that code.
Yes.
And it's very clear. Nobody needs to learn an API or props for that. Mm-hmm. That's the idea of the talk. And my hope is that people will be inspired by that to at least learn the patterns and find places to apply them appropriately. And then also go and discover new patterns as well. Yeah. The cool thing about software is that we're not learning or not discovering anything new most of the time. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, 20 years ago in computer science, they figured this thing out. Now, how does that apply in React?
Yeah.
Looking for different ways that we can increase the flexibility of our APIs and the simplicity at the same time.
Yeah.
That's what I'm excited about.
Nice. Well, I really like this. I'm excited to hear your talk. And thinking about what you're saying and kind of how that applies to libraries like Downshift, it feels more akin to this idea of a library, right? Where I'm giving you a library of components that you can use to compose a dropdown, right? Mm. I'm not giving you just a dropdown.
Yeah.
I'm giving you the tool set to create one. And with that is the power to say, you know what, this one part of this whole equation, like I love 99% of it, but like, I really wish that it did this one thing. Well, you can just pop the dropdown version out, write your own, and still keep the 99% benefit of using that library, mm-hmm. As opposed to having to throw the whole thing out because there's part of it that doesn't work quite like you want.
Yeah, exactly. And in that scenario, you're like, okay, I guess I'll file an issue.
Yeah.
And then the maintainer's like, oh no, another issue.
And there's so much complexity. I don't know how we can support this one last request.
Yeah, exactly. And then burnout.
Burnout, yeah. Like, done. Yeah. Somebody else take it.
Yeah. Yeah. These patterns are really cool and exciting, but I in my talk, I also give a caution about like, hey, listen, like we're shipping products. We're not shipping code.
Yeah.
Just remember that as exciting and fun as these patterns are, there is opportunity for overuse and premature abstraction. So if you're going to toss I think one of the most important things that we should be optimizing for when building software is deletability, mm-hmm. Because there's nothing more consistent in our industry than change. Yep. And the design will change, the business requirements will change, everything, like it's constantly changing. So you need to be able to be flexible enough to change.
Yeah.
And so some of these patterns are really good at that, like a render prop versus when I have control over rendering, then I'm not as flexible for you. But if you have control over rendering, then you are plenty flexible and you can make those changes. So that does kind of help optimize for change. Sometimes that can be a premature abstraction where it can make it harder for you to make changes as requirements come along because you're trying to solve for the world and you only have one use case.
Yeah.
So it's important to keep that in mind as well. There's nothing wrong with an if statement. There's nothing wrong with a ternary. I prefer ternaries, but there's nothing wrong with these things with conditional logic. Like at some point you got to ship something. So I would generally recommend like until you have three relatively distinct use cases, don't abstract too early. I would rather duplicate the code than have a bad abstraction.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite Ruby developers, Sandy Metz, always kind of talks about this idea of that design when applied correctly is allowing you to defer design. You're optimizing for change, knowing that like another requirement's going to come down the pipe and you know like the customer's not going to like this thing. And if you spend too much time trying to like make this thing perfect, something's inevitably going to break it. You said like the only constant in our job is change. And every time kind of coming back to, do we have to solve this problem now? Or can we like kind of like kick it along until we have a little bit more information? I feel like that's a really strong skill to have as a developer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one that I'm definitely still working on. I get really excited by these patterns. I'm like, sweet. Just like throw that in there, put a render prop on that thing. Like, you know, whatever. Yeah, it adds complexity for sure.
It does.
And so, yeah, a function adds complexity. Like you could take a 5-line function and make 5 functions out of it.
Yes.
For what? So like when people make a bunch of components out of a single, like you got a single component with, I don't know, like 50 lines of JSX and you're like, oh snap, we got to make like 7 components out of this thing. Like, okay, first of all, all that JSX, it's just a giant expression. So there's not too much going on in there. Like it's unlikely to break. So what are you really getting out of this abstraction?
I like to stay in one file for as long as I possibly can.
There's nothing wrong with that. React is capable of you building the entire application as a single component.
Yep. Cool. Well, we've been recording for almost 50 minutes now, so
we had a good time.
We did have a great time. So in closing, I just wanted to ask, what projects and people are you super excited about in kind of React and JavaScript right now?
Yeah. So Brent Jackson comes to mind because my slides are using his MDX deck.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier, he's prolific, just so much stuff.
So amazing.
And yeah, just like, hey, I'm just playing around with this amazing, awesome thing that I'm just throwing out there. Yeah. So
that library in particular, like he announced it and it was like, oh, cool. Like you write a markdown file and it shows your slides. And then you opened up just now and there's like a full presenter mode. It shows you like the next slide that's coming up.
Like, and this is like 2 weeks of work for him. And I'm like, what? And it synchronizes multiple windows. It's amazing. Really cool stuff. Yeah. So yeah.
So cosign on Brent Jackson.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. He's just fantastic. He works with, that Murmurs or cat avatar.
Yeah.
That individual is also just impressive person. Sunil Pai is my unsecret lover. He's just the greatest. He's just an awesome person who inspires a lot of really good ideas. Yeah. MDX was inspired by his idea. I built Babel plugin macros that's taking off. That was inspired by him.
CSS and JS. He had a lot of hand in that early development.
Yeah. Yeah. He has made a really big impact. Now he's doing React VR stuff and just like genius and a half. And so I really admire his stuff. Yeah. Sarah Drasner, I'll never be over her. Just she's an incredible developer.
Yeah.
Marcy Sutton is always doing great stuff for the accessibility community. So I'm always, I'm glad I remembered to think of her because she helped a lot in the accessibility of Downshift.
Awesome.
And so Downshift, as far as I know, and in my testing, Downshift is the most accessible component of its kind. Mm. And it's in large thanks to Marcy for the help that she put in there. Nitin Tulswani, he's an India. I've never met him. I'd love to meet him sometime, but he just builds the craziest stuff.
Yes.
Like, it was Redox X.
Yeah.
React renderer for Word documents. Like, what? I think he did it for fun, but like he was very involved in Glamorous, like on the kind of on the outskirts. So he built Glamorous primitives. He made, Glamorous. He rendered Glamorous to Sketch. He rendered Glamorous to Word. Just like did all this amazing, really cool stuff. Now, since I deprecated Glamorous, he made emotion primitives.
And oh, nice.
Yeah. So he's just jumping all over really awesome, impressive stuff. So I'm a huge fan of him. Also, Sean, I don't know his last name, but he spoke here at React Rally. He's just been really inspirational for a lot of people, I think. And I really appreciate him.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people I could keep going. Ryan Florence has been a really big inspiration for me too. So I'm happy to know him.
Yeah.
I call him my friend and he's a great person. Like more than just a developer, he's a really good
human.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm glad to know him.
Yeah. Well, we'll link all of these people so that
in the podcast, go follow them on Twitter. Yeah, they're great.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I know that what you have to say is going to help a lot of people. So I appreciate your time. Appreciate the fact that you're putting all of these great things into the world and helping people get better every day.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I say one more shout out?
Yeah, of course. Okay. Always.
If you care about testing in React, React Testing Library is great. Give that a look.
Links and show notes for this episode can be found at reactpodcast.com/21. You can now support the show on Patreon by visiting reactpodcast.com/partner. Your partnership goes a long way to support the ongoing production of this weekly show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week with a great conversation with Ryan Florence about Reach UI.